Well, welcome to our discussion of one of the great father and son combinations, the Maharit, the Mabit, and the Maharit, two great rabbis of Tzfat. This is part of our Kabbalistic rabbi series, although the Maharit and the Mabit are not Kabbalists per se, but we're going to share with you some works of some other rabbis from Tzfat, so we'll give you a full experience. I chose Maharit and Mabit because they're very colorful and very accomplished figures. So let's begin at the beginning with this discussion. So tonight we're going to learn about two characters that probably most of you have never heard of, Mabit and Maharit, but they're pretty significant in the world of halakha and the world of Jewish literature. As we'll see in a moment, pretty prolific. And but I know many of you are here to hear about Kabbalists, so we're also going to learn about some other Kabbalistic figures who were there as well. So so we'll focus on Maharit and Mabit, but we'll also share some Kabbalistic thoughts or semi-Kabbalistic thoughts from some others as well. So here we go. So really what we wanted to know was, aside from the great Ari and his student, the Chaim Vital, some other students he had, and aside from Yosef Karo, who else was hanging out in Tzfat? So tonight we're going to mention some other names. And so Maharit and Mabit, very, very important, as we'll see in a moment, see how significant they are. And I want to tie it in together also with the Yosef Karo and the Ari. How do these two rabbis fit in with them? You'll see. So just to get the name straight, the father was Rabbi Moshe ben Yosef of Trani, from the famous Yeshaya the Trani, the famous, they had ancestors who were very famous, Isaiah of Trani. So if you take the name, the acrostic, M-B-Y-T, Mabit. His son was Rabbi Yosef of Trani, who is the Maharit, Rabbi Yosef Trani. So we had the Mabit and the Maharit. And the ends in the eats because he's the son of Yosef Trani and his name is Yosef Trani. Okay. So one, the grandfather's name was Yosef, the grandson's name was Yosef as well. Now, so their names are cute. Very good. Okay, let's continue. The relationship to Rav Yosef Karo and the Ari. The Mabit and Rav Yosef Karo were both ordained by Mari Berav. So remember we talked about Rav Yosef Karo, he wrote the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law. Remember we talked about the fact that there was a new movement to ordain people, give them the official real ordination that everybody, all the rabbis would agree that they would be ordained. And the Rav Yosef Karo got such an ordination. Well, the Mabit also got that. He was a classmate in the school of Mari Berav, who was at that time the great rabbi. Today, a lot of people don't know about him, but in those days, he was the one who inspired the idea of giving smicha to everybody. And so Mabit and Rav Karo are classmates. Are they going to remain friendly? We'll see later. The Mabit took over as Rosh Beit Din after Yosef Karo died. So if you wonder, well, who takes over after the author of the Shulchan Aruch? Who takes over the Sfat? Mabit. Yosef Karo on selling Israel to Gentiles. Today, the problem is when the sabbatical year comes, so we say, well, we don't really want to take off a year, so what should we do? So we sell it to a Gentile. Some people say, no, you can't sell it to a Gentile. If you sell it to Gentiles, does it cease to be Israel? Can you then work the land or not? So this is an interesting question today. In those days, they weren't so much farmers. As we'll see later, they were dealing in textiles. They were in the shmata business. But they wanted to know, the produce in the sabbatical year is a free-for-all. Anybody can take it. I can walk into your field and take your oranges. And therefore, since it doesn't belong to anybody, you don't have to give truma and maaser. You don't have to take off a tenth for this, a tenth for that, 2% for this. You don't have to take off all those things in the sabbatical year if it belonged to a Jew, because it's a sabbatical year. But a lot of the produce came from the Arabs, and that they're not Jewish. And if they're not considered, if they're considered to have acquired the land and it's not holy anymore, then it's not the sabbatical year anymore. And if it's not the sabbatical year, you have to take tithing. So it's a big question. When you go to the supermarket, in the sabbatical year of, I think it was 1658, they had a sabbatical year. You go to the market, you have to take off, it's a pain in the neck, you have to take off 10% for this, 2% for this, 10% for that, another 10% for something else. Do you have to do that or not? So the Mabit said, no, you don't have to do it. And the Maritz and the Rav Yosef Karo said, what do you mean? We always did that. How could you say that? They had a big debate. And on his deathbed, they made up. Rav Yosef Karo gave a bracha to the little Maritz, to the younger of the two rabbis that we're talking about tonight. The Alshich and Rav Moshe were ordained Maribe Rav and were students and a student of Rav Karo. Okay, fine. He's now the Alshich. We're going to talk tonight about one of the great Kabbalists of Tzfat, the Alshich, or Moshe Alshich. He's originally from Greece. He said he saw a great light over the home of the Maharit of his home when he was the night he was born. Alshich is a great mystic. If you're a great mystic and you're walking by a house and they're having a baby, and it turns out that the baby is the Maharit, who we'll see is a great rabbi. So then if you're the Alshich, you say, you know what? There was a great light over that home. Because the Alshich is a mystic. This is what goes on in Tzfat. And sure enough, the Maharit will be a great rabbi, as we'll see. Now, the mystic Rav Moshe Kurdovero, the teacher of the Ari, okay, you can't get much bigger than that, the teacher of the Ari, he had chosen Maharit's name before he's born. So you see, they're all connected. The Maharit, the younger of the two rabbis we're talking about tonight, we're talking about the Mabit and the Maharit, the younger of the two, his name was chosen by the great Kabbalist who taught the Ari. So we see how all these people are connected. We'll have other connections later as well.
That sounds Spanish, Cordovero.
Correct, correct. Most of the people we're talking about are of Spanish origin. Trani, also, they are originally a Sephardic as well. Now, another thing, the younger of the two rabbis we're talking about tonight, the Maharit, was married a granddaughter of Yosef Karo. He was orphaned from the Mabit. The Mabit died when the Maharit was young. He was orphaned at 12. And he studied under Moshe Shlomo Sagiz, who is his teacher? The father-in-law of the Ari. So we're talking about a small community. We're going to see later they may have had 10,000 people, but it's about the size of Memphis. Memphis Jews, about 10,000 Jews, and you know everybody. And if you're a great rabbi, you're connected to all the other great rabbis. That's the way it works. Okay, so we have all these connections between the Maharit, the Mabit, that's the Mabit and the Maharit, the father and son combination we're talking about tonight, and the other two rabbis we've been talking about, the Rav Yosef Karo and the Ari. You get a sense of the tremendous amount of rabbis. Now, tonight I wanted to answer the question, why Tzfat? Why now? Why in the 1600s is Tzfat this big deal? So there's a very unique story, and it's particularly interesting, those interested in women leaders. There's a woman named Donna Gracia. She also named herself Nasi. She was originally Catholic. She was one of those conversos who pretended to be Catholic. And then when she was able to move to more free countries, she freed herself. She was accused of, you know, being someone who left Catholicism. And she was in jail for a while. But eventually, she gets the inheritance of her brother, who does not give the inheritance to his wife, but gives it to his sister. And she becomes a very important figure in Italy, Turkey, and in Tzfat as well. Listen to this. In 1558, which I said was a sabbatical year, she was granted long-term lease on the Tiberias region, which includes Tzfat, although it's not that close, in the Galilee, which was part of the Ottoman Syria at that time, from Sultan Suleiman the Magnificent. Famous Suleiman the Magnificent. There are pieces of architecture in Israel with that have his name on it, in exchange for guaranteeing a substantial increase in the yearly tax revenues. So she was going to guarantee a certain amount of dollars per year to the Sultan, and then he'd be happy. But it was largely a desolate place. It really wasn't a great place to rent. As a result, she obtained ruling authority over the Tiberias area. Sultan, she then began to rebuild the area's abandoned towns to make them available to refugees. Refugees meaning the people who, 1492, there were been, since 1492, they've been wandering around the world. They could come here and they could settle there if they wished. Her aim was to make Tiberias into a new major center of Jewish settlement, trade, and learning. A Jewish traveler who visited Tiberias around this time mentions how she lent support to the Jewish community and how after her death, they were compelled to ask for Jewish donations elsewhere. So the Maharit, the younger of the two rabbis we're talking about tonight, is going to have to go schnorr money. He's going to have to become a shluach d'rabbanan, a schnorr, what's a good nice word for schnorr?
A
mashulach who collects donations to find money. But you'll see, he's going to make an opportunity out of it rather than just becoming a schnorr. But so the Maharit is sort of the end of this whole period, because by the time he's around, he's got to collect money to give to the sultan. But as long as she's around, this Dona Gracia, and we'll have to see evidence that the Maharit and Mabit were aware of Dona Gracia, and they talked about Dona Gracia, and they loved Dona Gracia, we will see in a moment. So now, why not Jerusalem? Why are we in Tzfat? If I had a chance to live in Israel, if I had all the money in the world, I probably would live in Jerusalem. Now, some people disagree. They say you should live elsewhere, whatever. But, right, most people like to live in Jerusalem. Until recently, it became so expensive, everyone lived somewhere else. But in my parents' days, when it was affordable, everybody I knew lived in Jerusalem. So why didn't they live in Jerusalem then? So there's a text I saw online from a Franciscan priest, whatever his name was. He said, these dogs, the Jews, are steeped upon, beaten and tortured as well as they should be, he says. They live in this land in conditions of submission that no words can describe, particularly in Jerusalem, where even the Muslims treat them like dogs. So if you ask, why didn't all these great rabbis live in Jerusalem? There were rabbis in Jerusalem, and one of the rabbis who didn't like the whole ordination thing was in Jerusalem. But these rabbis chose to live in a more pleasant place, where Dona Gracia was basically the governor. It was the beginning of a Jewish state. It was a little bit of a feeling that there was a Jewish state. So there was economic activity. She tried to plant certain trees so they could have silk industry. It was an unbelievable confluence of all these things. She's also in exile from Spain, but she's wealthy. And it was unbelievable. She's a real lady of the highest order. She's like a society lady. But an activist. And her nephew, Yosef Nasi, also very, very crucial. Now, by the mid-16th century, there may have been 10,000 Jews. So think of it as like Memphis. It's small. There's not a lot of people, but it's big for those days. There probably weren't 10,000 Jews in the rest of Israel. There were always Jews in Israel, but not always very many. They had a good clothing industry. At the end of the 16th century, after Dona Gracia died, politics changed. Some Druze took over. The Mabit left. So, the Maharit left. Reb Chaim Vital left, the student of the Ari. He went to Damascus. The greatest student of the Ari, he went to Damascus. Rabbi Yeshaya Hurwitz, the Shalah, a great mystic, he went to Jerusalem. So the Tzfat, by the end, it's really in the 16th century, the 1600s, 17th century, that the Tzfat is such a great place. That's when the Ari thrived. That's when Yosef Karo, many other rabbis, 10,000 Jews. But after that, it was much more difficult. There was also a famine and a plague. It was like today, it was rough. Okay, now, so if Dona Gracia was the governor and Mabit was the chief rabbi after Rabbi Yosef Karo, what did he say about her? So he paraphrased the verse in Friday Night Song, many daughters have done mightily, but Hannah, I guess that was her name, has risen above them all. That's from the book of Cecil Roth on Dona Gracia. Wonderful book. The Maharit, that's the son, in his chuvot, in his responsa, refers to the signora. She was known as a signora. He says, the giveret chalkam b'chayim, may they live and be well. They're anshei emes oni batza. They're very honest and truthful people. They always listen to the rabbis, except for this. There's a particular story where they didn't listen, and it may have had something to do with the inheritance. Her whole life, she was fighting with her sister over who was supposed to get the inheritance from her sister's husband. Okay, so they refer to her the señora.
That's a title of respect also in Spain.
Yes?
The señora, not just señora, the señora.
Right. So in one of the responsa of the Mabit, they both, the father and son, the Mabit and Maharit, they both wrote responsa. In the older one's responsa, he says, well, he talks about a certain case, and he says, There was a rule in those days in Turkey that anybody could go to whatever synagogue they wanted to. They could sign up. They weren't locked in. Like, you know, sometimes if you belong to Anshe, we don't let you go anywhere else. You try to go to somewhere else, we clobber you, right? No. But So there was a question, you know, could you change congregation? When you signed up officially that you're part of this congregation, can you go to another congregation? So he says, no, there's a rule. There was an agreement. You go wherever you want, or you could go to the Kehilah of the Giveret. If you want, you could sign up to the congregation of a senora. What do we mean? He was such a great patron that there were synagogues named after the senora. There was the Dona Gracia synagogue. She was a patron of rabbis and of shuls and of entire cities, communities, and she was like the first prime minister of Israel in 16-something rather.
Now, really?
Well, that's the question. There's apparently not that much literature on that, and you know, there's still some questions about it, but more or less it was something like that. She didn't like Tzfat. It was too dingy for her. She liked Tiberias. It's on the ocean. It's on the river and the lake, yeah. The Kinneret. It's much more pretty. So she preferred Tiberias. She tried to build that up. So I don't know what happened. Why Tzfat became the big deal? But anyway,
this is incredible. Thank you.
Yes, thank you for joining us, and I'm glad you appreciate it. Now, as I said, at some point, Tzfat, as the great Tzfat, and there were always Jews in Tzfat, but it closed as the great Tzfat. In 1596, there was a siege, there was a famine, they had difficulties, and the Maharit had to go with another rabbi to be a shadar, to be a shulchan rabbanon, to be a meshulach, and to raise money for the community. And then, eventually, Rav Yosef, the Maharit, the younger of the two rabbis we're talking about tonight, he had to go to Constantinople, known as Kushta in Hebrew. He and another rabbi had to go collect monies to pay the taxes, which used to be paid by Dona Gracia single-handedly. So she was like Bill Gates, she could pay the tax for the whole country. And now, rabbis had to collect the money. The people locally, there were famines. It wasn't what it used to be. So this great opportunity, this bubble, this moment in history, this century in history, where Jews could flower and Torah could flower, and the community could blossom in Tzfat, it wasn't for us. A moment in time. And what an incredible moment it was. Now, tonight I want to talk about the Maharit and Mabit, but I didn't want to disappoint. Really, we should have talked about Rabbi Moshe Alshich. He's a great... He was a great Kabbalist. Now, I talked to my friend, Professor Brill, tonight, and he said the following. I saw some people said that Rav Moshe Alshich, although he was a great Kabbalist, his books are not that Kabbalistic. See what he says right here. He says, I never aimed too high or beyond me. I settled in Tzfat. And what did he study? He studied Talmud. That was his main occupation. And he went to the yeshiva, and he learned about Abai and Rava, the main rabbis in the Talmud. And the night he devoted to research and halacha, and the day during the day halacha, in the morning he read the Talmud. In the afternoon he read the legal scholars, the decisors. Only on Fridays he would do scripture, the Tanakh, the Midrash. However, Rav Moshe Alshich wrote volumes and volumes on the Torah. Today, when you search for any topic, any piece of Talmud, any Midrash, in the Bar Ilan search, in the computer search, you will find that Alshich always has something to say about it, because he talked about everything. He was a great scholar, but he devoted his writings were about Chumash. So I saw some people wrote that it wasn't so Kabbalistic. Rabbi Alan Brill, who's a great professor of mysticism and all that, he said, no, there is a lot of Kabbalah in the Alshich, but on the surface, it doesn't look so Kabbalistic. It looks more, he wrote it in a way that everybody can understand what he's talking about. So unlike the Ari, who some of you yourselves said to me, you don't know what he's talking about. When it came to the Alshich, he was more understandable. So there was, in Tzfat, there weren't only Kabbalists. There were also the Mabit, the Maharit, as we'll learn about. There were people like Moshe Alshich, who gave drushes that were readily understandable. They were not so deep in Kabbalah that you couldn't, that you had to be a Kabbalist to follow. So I wanted to share with you a couple of pieces from the Alshech to get a little sense of one of the great Kabbalists of Tzfat before we go back to Marit and Mabit, who were in Tzfat, but were not great Kabbalists. So I thought I'd share with you something about this week's Parsha, Parsha Truma. So it says, you know, Vasuli Mikdash, you should make a Mikdash, you should make a temple. So he says, I'm sorry, I don't have a translation. Here it goes. He says, your ears should ring when you hear something like this. He says, how can one who dwells up high among the light, how can he, you're going to make a place that people made? And he says, Solomon himself wondered when he made the temple, can God live on the earth? And of course, we say that this place is a Mount Moriah. And he says, the answer is, he says, that's the gate of heaven. So, and the reason that it's holy is because it corresponds to the temple of the temple that's above in heaven. As the rabbis say, that machon l'shivtecha, mechuvan l'shivtecha, there's a parallel between the temple here and the temple above. It's parallel. It's lined up. Again, this is not a physical thing. It's a metaphor. And therefore, and also because the Adam was made from the place where he'll be atoned from, the dirt on Mount Moriah. On Mount Moriah, that's what the dirt with which God made man. So that's why our atonement comes from that place. And that's where they have an altar on high. So what do they offer on the altar on high? They don't have sheep. They offer the souls of the righteous. And on down here, we offer sacrifices. So the rabbis say, if you go into the base Mikdash down here, the God considers it as if you went into the base Mikdash above. And the Kohen who brings it, it's as if he's offering it on the temple on high in the heaven. And it's as if the temple on high comes down into the temple below. It's as if the temple above and below are in one place. And therefore, you shouldn't be surprised if God lives there, because it's the same place. It's all one. And that's what Shlomo said, that I really built two, Bano Baniti, I built two houses. The Beis HaMikdash is there are two buildings. I'm building it here and building it above. Where is the second one? He says, it parallels one to the other. So, and he goes on, he says, when we made a Mishkan, a tabernacle, so did the angels. They also made one. And when we put a tabernacle here, they put one there as well. Who was in charge of the one above? The chief angel named Metatron. He offers the souls of the righteous to atone for the Jews in exile. So when a Jew, this is very comforting. If you're a Spanish Jew and you knew Jews who were persecuted, Jews who were burnt at the stake for the Inquisition. So you say, all those souls, they were brought by the angel on high on the temple and above to atone for us while we live in exile. And when it says Et HaMishkan, it means the Mishkan, the tabernacle there, and there was another tabernacle that came with that tabernacle. And that's why it says it's a place for that God made with his own hands. So he says, what is the Mishkan of God? Is it above or where is it? So he says, it's specifically for exile. So he says, why can't you have one temple? Why do you need two? So he says that, so apparently this is specifically for us in exile. The temple above continues to function even in exile. And there is an idea that wherever you are, look at this. He says here, Kol makom shelamata. He's wherever we have a holy place here, then above, there's also something similar to it as well. So wherever you go, this is true as well. Then there's another rabbi we should know, the Shalah. He was more of a Tiberian than he was from Tzfat, but he's buried in Tzfat, and let's throw him in to Tzfat as well. And I believe he also had smicha in one of the later other generations as well. So what does he say about Truma? So the Shalah says, who was a Kabbalist, he says, well, if you look in one of the earlier rabbis, the Baal Turim, he says, Truma has the same letters as Torah, Mem. The Torah was given in 40 days. He says, what's the connection of Truma? We're talking, this Parsha is talking, not talking about the Torah. This Parsha is talking about the Avodah, about the worship of God in the tabernacle. Why does the first word Truma, the name of our Parsha, hint to the word of Torah? Because the whole purpose of the tabernacle is to put the Aron there that has the Ten Commandments. Because Torah is the highest value. So again, this is the type of Kabbalah that's not disconnected from Torah. It's Torah and Kabbalah together. And then he says that there are three parts, the alphabet can be divided into three parts, as it explains in the earlier Kabbalistic words of Sefer Yetzirah. And there are different types of letters. And all, if you look at all the different types of metals, all the ingredients of the tabernacle, it's these 22 things that are divided into different sections. Good. Now, and today, the rabbi saying brachos in the Talmud that our table can atone. How? When we feed the poor on our table and we speak Torah at our table can function like the original table that they had in the temple. He goes on, he says that the bread should always be there. Why are they called Lechem HaPanim? Why are the 12 showbread called the bread of faces? What's it got to do with faces? So he says, the idea of a holy table is a table that you share with the poor people. And when you give to the poor people, you have to have panim. You have to have nice face. When you give charity, you have to give it with a smile. The Rambam says if you give charity with a frown, it doesn't count. So, and you should remember that God gives to us with a smiley face. We should give to him with a smiley face. We should give to others with a smiley face as well. This idea that the tabernacle is based on the Torah, that the Torah is the main thing. Rabbi Schachter in our own day has said that the whole holiness of a synagogue is because of the Torah. The Torah is in the synagogue. And that's why the Aron Kodesh should be in the room that you're in. That's the holiness of a synagogue. Not just the people pray there, but the temple, the same thing in the temple. It's the temples. But in the second temple, they didn't have a Torah. So they say, no, it was buried in a certain place in the temple. And therefore, the second temple was holy because it had a Torah buried somewhere. The Ark was buried in that temple.
They didn't have a sefer in the second temple? They didn't have a sefer Torah?
They had a sefer Torah, but well, that's true. They did have a sefer Torah. What about the Ark? So he says, the temple needs an Ark also. It was just buried.
Right.
So what do we see? We saw that in addition to the great Mabit and Marit we're going to talk about tonight, there were also two great mystics who lived in that area, Rabbi Moshe Alshich, and got a little flavor of his writings and the Shalah about the tabernacle and the idea that there's a heavenly tabernacle parallel to ours, and there's a tabernacle where the souls of the righteous are offered. If you recall, last week we said that, 2 weeks ago, that the Ari had a vision that he would be martyred. He wanted to be martyred because to be offered on that special altar is a very special thing. Okay. Of course, he didn't do anything to contribute to the martyring, but he wasn't martyred, but it was everyone's dream to be a martyr. Okay. Again, you don't throw yourself to kill yourself. But if it happens to you, you're happy. Okay. So back to Mabit Marit. Let's talk about father and son duos. How many great father and son combinations are there? Not that many. Rabbi Gamliel and Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, the whole Hillel dynasty. The Gamliels and the Hillel, that was a dynasty. True. Shimon Bar Yochai and Rabbi Lazar Rabbi Shimon, two great rabbis. True. Although Rabbi Lazar was not as great as Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. The Rush and the Tour, we talked about them a few weeks ago. Rush started in Germany. He had to leave. He went to Spain. And he wrote a compendium of the Talmud and very, very important book for Ashkenazim mostly. And the Tur was his son And he wrote the first prototype of the Code of Jewish Law to father and son combination. Also the Salvagic dynasty, very great rabbis, going all the way from the Beis HaLevi to Reb Chaim to the Brisker Rav to the Rav, and to this day, also great dynasty. But the Mabit and Marit will definitely go down in history as a great dynasty of two great rabbis. What's so great about them? Let's get to it. What's the big deal? Why is the rabbi talking about Mabit and Marit? Who cares? Who are they? Look at this. Look at this. Here are their accomplishments. So we have in the left column the Mabit, the right side, the Marit. The Mabit, the father, Moshe, studied with Rav Yosef Karo under the Yaakov Beira. Pretty great. He got smicha. He was a student with Rav Yosef Karo. He corresponded with Rav Yosef Karo, with the Radvaz in Egypt, another great rabbi at that time, the Al-Sheikh, who we talked about before. He wrote a book on the Rambam, Kiryat Sefer, summarizing the Rambam. We'll see later, we're going to get, just to give you real flavor of the Mabit, we're going to read from his book, Beit Elohim. It's a funny name. It's a name of a book that has God's name in it. The House of God. It's going to be on Tefillah, on Teshuvah, and the 13 principles of the Rambam. He wrote a commentary on the Perek Shira. Perek Shira is a funny song. It's a song that was at least 1,000 years old about how every creature sings to God. And he wrote a commentary on that, one of the first commentaries on that. And he took over the Beit Din after Rabbi Yosef Karo died. He was the chief rabbi of Tzfat after Rabbi Yosef Karo died. So that's a lot of accomplishments. Mabit. What about the Ma'arit, his son, who was orphaned at 12 years old? He studied with the Seder Hayom. He couldn't study with his father, but he studied with another rabbi who wrote the book Seder Hayom. We studied that in Anshe years ago. He was the head of the yeshiva in Tzfat. He headed his father's shul. We still know the name of the shul. He became the chief. When he went to Constantinople as a schnorrer to raise money, they were so impressed with him, they made him the chief rabbi. He was the head of a yeshiva. There was a businessman there who contributed half of his profits to the rabbi. And he lived a very nice life there in Constantinople. Wow. Didn't know about it anymore. So it was falling apart. It was dangerous. And he was the teacher of so many students. They're more obscure, but one of the famous ones was the Knesset HaGdolah, one of the greatest Sephardic rabbis of the last 400 years, Knesset HaGdolah, Benvenisti. You may have heard the name Benvenisti. He was his teacher. He inspired many brilliant students in Constantinople. When you have a great scholar, people come, all the bright young people, they come, they sop it up, they eat it up, and all of a sudden you have an explosion of students in Constantinople, in Turkey, in the Ottoman Empire, because of the Marit. He wrote 3 volumes of Tshuvot. The Mabit also wrote Tshuvot, Responsa. And he also, Marit, had the distinction that he wrote on the Talmud. We have his book on Kiddushin, on Shabbat. We still have it. He wrote on Tshuvot. And he wrote a book about the Beit HaMikdash, apropos to the feeling that the Mashiach was in the air at that time. He wrote about it. Now, again, these are not mystics. So it's interesting. You have the Ari, even Rav Yosef Karo, great mystics living side by side with the Mabit Marit. They're not mystics. So it's interesting that you had the two living side by side. And again, there's a lot of connections between the Mabit Marit and the Ari. Shlomo Alkabetz, the one who wrote the Lecha Dodi. There are connections, but they're not Kabbalists. It's interesting. Here's an example of some of the Sha'arim, the front page of their books, of the Mabit's book. He has Tshuvot and Tshuvot. Notice it says Moshe Mitrani. And it says Sfat, right? And then this book, Beit Elokim, also printed in Venice, but it's from Rabbi Yosef, Moshe ben Rabbi Yosef, the Mabit.
Excuse me. Rabbi Yochai in Moran, which is like, you can see it from Sfat,
right?
Wrote the Zohar, and what year was that? Was it
okay? The Zohar is a complicated thing. The Zohar is attributed to Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai. Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai lived around the time of Rabbi Akiva, so around the year 200. But the Zohar, as we have it today, as a book, those particular words were written in the 1200s, 13th century. But again, if you're a real mystic, you wouldn't like that statement. You would say, it was written by Shimon bar Yochai, period, end of report. Most scholars would say, well, fine, maybe those are the words of the great mystic from a million years ago, but the book Zohar comes out in the 1200. Okay, moving along. So let's dive in a little bit.
Question, please. Yeah. The second RE synagogue that's down there near the cemetery, that was closed up for quite a long time. And it was like four rabbis trying to go in and they tied a rope around their arm or their leg and they died. And then it was Rabbi Akiva that made it in, did whatever, and they were able to come out alive. And then it was all okay.
Shira, I you're very knowledgeable of a lot of things. I'm not familiar with that, so I can't endorse it. Thumbs up, thumbs down. So I can't say. Shira knows a lot of stuff. It's interesting. It's a great story. Go check it out, everybody. Could be, but I can't endorse. I'm not saying not. I don't know. I'm just not familiar with that. But Shira had the privilege of living in Tzfat, so she knows some of the lore there. It's great, and you can look into it. But the Ari Shul today apparently is not the main Ari Shul today is not exactly the original Ari Shul. But anyway, not our topic right now. I wanted to get deeper into Mabit. Let's read a little bit from the Mabit and see what one of the great scholars of Tzfat, it's not mysticism, but it's about spirituality. Let's see what he says about prayer. So he has some very interesting things to say about prayer. And I thank Asher for underscoring some of these points on prayer. So, one student suggested, Lenny suggested that maybe Shira is referring to the four students. Rabbi Akiva lived before Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. He was a teacher of Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva was a teacher, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai is a student. And there were four great mystics who went to heaven and only Rabbi Akiva survived. But in any event, we got to move on. The Mabit. He wrote this book, Beit Elokim, which is about prayer, repentance, and the 13 principles of faith. So on prayer, listen to some of the interesting things he says about prayer. I hope you'll find it inspiring. He says, what is prayer? He says, I'll give you one sentence of what it is. It's the request of a person from God for something that is needed and that is not in his or her control. It's a very audacious statement. He says, what do I mean by that? He says, a person should pray for mercy. So what does he mean? The request of a person from God for something that is, so number one, he says that prayer is requests. Now later he's going to claim that in the end of days when we don't need anything, so then prayers will just be praise. But one might argue that no, the essence of prayer is request, like he says, but it's not because we're so pathetic we have requests. That is prayer. Prayer is request. It's for something that's needed. He claims that if it's something frivolous, you shouldn't pray for it. You don't want to bother God for no reason. Now, I have mixed feelings about that. On the one hand, look, if I'm so foolish that my most important thing is that the Red Sox should win the game tonight or something like that, so maybe that's my need. I'll cry if they lose. So maybe that is a need. Or maybe no. You have to have good values. And when you pray, it should reflect good values. I don't know. Is it bothering God? If you, let's say, you want your boyfriend to get you roses for your birthday, and you see you pray for, is that bad? That's what you want. So he claims that it is bad. A person should pray for mercy as if he's not worthy of it, as from her deeds. Now, Talmud, this is also a controversial statement. Talmud says that when it comes to charity, you can say, look, God, please heal this person on the merit or the credit that I'm giving charity. However, Yuri's claiming that you should not say I should be answered because of anything I did. We find this regarding Moses. And Moses prayed for a freebie. He didn't say, God, I've done all these things for you. Can't you let me into Israel? He said, look, I'm begging you to go to Israel. Why is he begging? Why doesn't he say, I'm the best Jew who ever lived, so let me in? He didn't say that. So too, certainly we, we're not Moses. We should not pray because we're worthy. However, I just want to point out the Christians happen to agree with that. They don't think that we ever have any merit at all. I think generally speaking, we do think we have merit. We do certain things. It does give us certain merit. So I don't know. It's an interesting idea. Next, he says a person should not pray for that which is not necessary. As we said, the definition of prayer is something necessary. You don't want to bother God for no reason. an interesting idea. Not sure I agree. If we can do it ourselves naturally, we should not ask God to do miracles and help us. Interesting idea. Can you ask for miracles? You can ask for miracles. You can't rely on a miracle, but you could ask God for a miracle. Now, if you could ask God for a miracle, so then why not? So he says, no. If you can help it, do something yourself. Let's say I could study for the test tomorrow, or I could ask God, give me a miracle that I'll know all the answers so I could pass the test. He said, you can't do that. So obviously it's good advice. You have to take certain actions. You can't just pray. But the idea that you have to do everything naturally is a very extreme kind of an idea. Then he says, the purpose of prayer is not to be answered, but to show that there is no one in the world worthy to pray other than to God. When we will be redeemed, our prayers will be just praise like the angels. Again, one might argue that if prayer will ever exist in the future, it has to be based on a request. Even if we're redeemed, we still have to have requests. But he says, no, when we're redeemed, we'll just be like angels. We'll just praise God all the time. Like on Shabbos, we don't ask for anything. We just praise God. It's like the end of days. This idea that the idea of prayer is not to be answered is not very comforting, not very spiritual. Right? What do you mean? Why am I praying? He says you're really just affirming that it is God who is worthy to pray for. Well, why is he worthy to pray for? He's worthy to pray to because he might answer, or he could answer. He's capable of answering. So it's a very interesting idea. He says the mitzvah of prayer is not like other mitzvah in which intent may not be needed. He says, maybe you can get the mitzvah of tefillin or sukkah without having intent, without knowing what you're doing. When it comes to prayer, the main thing is intent. And that's what Chaim Soloveitchik, hundreds of years later, said the same thing. And we say at the end of our prayers, hear our prayers. Why do we ask God to hear our prayers? We already said the prayers. He says, even if we didn't have proper intent, that God should hear our prayers, even if we didn't have. So it's interesting. On the one hand, he says, prayer is meaningless if it's only as deep as your lips. But on the other hand, he says, we ask God, have mercy on us, even though my prayer was terrible. I was only moving my lips. I didn't know what I was saying. I was thinking about something else. Please answer the prayers anyway. So it's interesting. Why do we need a minion? Because, he says, most of the things we need a minion for are praising God. Think about it. Kaddish, Kedusha, holy, holy, holy is God. Baruch Hu, to thank, praise God. He says, you're going to praise God with a small crowd, right? Right? You need a big crowd. Like Mr. Weinreich says, I don't want to sing for less than 100 people, right? You got to have a nice crowd. So if you're going to praise God, you got to have a nice group. So that's why he claims to have a minion. It's his unique theory. It doesn't say that anywhere else. And we have a problem. When we say a blessing for a mitzvah, give me an example, reading the Megillah. So we say, blessed are you, God, our God, who commanded us in his commandments. There's a big problem. Rabbi Soloveitchik talks about it, but this rabbi talked about it 400 years earlier. Why is there a contradiction between how we start off the blessing and how we end the blessing? We start off talking to God directly, second person, right? You. And then we switch to third person, he, his. What's going on? So he says, we begin, when we're talking about mitzvahs, we start off, we're chosen people. We're speaking directly as if it was to be at Sinai, as if we're at Mount Sinai, God's talking to us directly. Then we switch to a third person, as we recall, how at Mount Sinai, we decided to let Moses speak to us because we were not ready and we were scared. So that yin and yang, that give and take, that yes and no, that we felt, that ambivalence that we felt at Mount Sinai, do we want to speak to God directly? Don't we want to speak to God directly? That ambivalence is reflected in every blessing when we say a blessing. We say, blessed are you. I'm going to talk to you directly. A Jew can have direct access to God. And then we, as Rabbi Soloveitchik says, we jump back and we say, whoa, who am I to talk to God? And I saw recently one rabbi said that when we say the word king, that changes everything. When we say the word king, we say, wait, the king? Ah! He starts shaking. And you turn to third person. Okay. At times of sorrow, we scream our prayers. Rabbi Soloveitchik talks about this as a new idea 30 years ago, but the Mabit talked about this 400 years ago, that in a time of sorrow, when you have a famine, you have plague like we have today, we have to use slichos. We have to scream our prayers. What does it mean to scream the prayers? It could be figurative or literal, to reflect the intensity. There are two types of prayer. There's regular prayer, and there are times when something more intense, like slichot, are in place. So many ideas that the Mabit expresses, Rabbi Soloveitchik expressed many years later, unbeknownst to him, because most people don't read the Mabit. Rabbi Soloveitchik, I don't know if he, you know, was well versed in the Mabit. So we had a little flavor and a taste of the Mabit and his book about prayer. Let's now turn to the Mabit in his debate with Rav Yosef Karo. So we have something, there's an interesting question. If I'm trying to present that the Mabit was really one of the great rabbis of all time, and part of the argument is, well, you know, he took over Rabbi Karo. The question is, who won? When the Mabit and the Rav Yosef Karo were fighting, who won? So we have two versions. Some say that at the end of his life, the Rav Yosef Karo not only gave a bracha to the Mabit's son, the Marit, but also he agreed to the Mabit. And some say, what do you mean? He never changed his mind. And the custom continues. So look at this. It was a very hot debate. Listen to this. If something grows in the sabbatical year in the hands of the Gentiles, the Arabs, so the Marit says that my father, the Mabit, decided that they are obligated in all the laws of Shemitah, of the sabbatical year. You have to be very, you can't throw it away. If you eat a banana in the sabbatical year, you eat half of it. You say, I don't want the other half, says your four-year-old. He says, well, you're going to eat it whether you like it or not. Or you take it and you put it in the windowsill. You put it on your counter. You wait till it rots because you can't throw it away because it's holy food. But that's the bad news. But the good news is you don't have to take 10% and 20% and 2%, and you don't have to give it to the Kohen or the Levi or anything else. And that's what everybody did every year. And the great rabbis said that even though Rabbi Karo was, you know, not sure about this, and he decided to be strict about this, and he would take the truest and maestros, he would take the tithing without making a bracha because he wasn't sure. Later, my father of blessed memory forced him and the rabbis there together with him that they should not take tithing at all. Because by taking the tithing, then what happens? What if someone eats the I put it aside for the Kohen, and then my son eats it. Then he ate something holy. It's not a good idea. So the Marit, the son of the Marit, claims that the Rav Yosef Karo, the author of the Shulchan Aruch, changed his mind, agreed to him, and everybody agreed with him. All right. And the Chidah says, the Chidah was a great Sephardic mystic. He also passed through that region, but a little later. He says, one of the great Hasidic, Sephardic authorities of Jewish law, and he wrote many, many books on Chumash and other things. And in the code of Jewish law, he has a comment there. So he says, when the Shulchan Aruch was written, what did the Rav Yosef Karo write in the Shulchan Aruch? That you don't take tithing on the sabbatical year. He agreed with the Mabit. The Mabit won. He beat the Shulchan Aruch on this point. That's what the Chidah says. However, there are those who say Yavkat Rochel is the book of the Rav Yosef Karo's responsa. So Rav Yosef Karo writes, when a certain wise man, Rav Moshe Mitrani, the Mabit, wrote again a second time, he wrote this, he alludes to Achashverosh, he wrote another Megillah, and he wanted to act upon his words on the last Shemitah, and people objected. And in this year, 1874, he hardened his heart like Pharaoh. He dared with his heart, with his spirit, to remain firm, and with a strong arm. These are all biblical expressions from the Exodus and do not have a good connotation. And everybody got together and they looked into his words and they saw there was no basis for the Mabit's words. And they announced in the synagogues that they would put someone in Chirim, in isolation, in Chirim. What's a good translation of Chirim? Ban them. It would ban
excommunication.
Excommunication.
There you go.
If that everybody had to separate Truma Maisra from the Goyish of fruits, that if a Jew winnowed it, if a Jew prepared it, just like every other year. That's what Rabbi Yosef Karo said, the young Rabbi Yosef Karo. So we have two versions. One says everybody agreed with Mabit. One says they didn't. Back to the Mabit. Mabit writes in the 25th Teshuvah. He says, there's a story. He says, Rav Yosef Karo used to teach that he should take Maaser. And he told me that I should send him what I wrote. And I sent it to him. And he tried to push off my proofs, which I wrote. And to me, everything he said are easily pushed off. It's like straw. You could just blow it away. And I don't even need to respond to what he said about me, except some of the things he's about to say. So it was a very hot debate. And there's a report that the Shulchan Aruch forgave the Mabit before he died. And that's why Mabit was able to become the chief rabbi after Rav Yosef Karo. So we're playing with the big boys now. These are the big titans. And this is a great debate between the two about whether during the sabbatical year, do they get a break? Could they not separate the tithing that year or not? This was the big debate. To this day, there's a big debate. Can you sell the land to the Gentiles? Does that work if you sell it to a Gentile? Okay. So really, well, what have we described here? And I want to finish, because I know in deference to other classes that are going on, we had the Ari, great mystic, unbelievably started a whole new type of mysticism, new ideas of Yosef Karo. He heard the voice of an angel in his mouth, and he wrote the Code of Jewish Law. Chaim Vital, great student of the Ari, the Mabit, the Marit, giants in Torah scholarship, Shalah and the Alshech, great writers on the Chumash and on mysticism. Shlomo Alkabetz wrote the Lachadodi, a mystical song, and he wrote other mystical books and also a commentary on the Megillah, which was not mystical. So they were capable of switch hitting. They could write mystical, not mystical, whatever they want. It was a magical time. It was a mystical time, a time of growth and hope. And an interesting question, was it a forerunner to modern Zionism? Was it like, did it give the first inkling that, you know what? Jews could set up an economic base and bring rabbis and you can have a wonderful time in Israel. Are we seeing a similar uptick in mystics and scholars to this day? That's my question for you tonight. So this concludes the Mary Haken Dumont series on Jewish mystics and Tzfat. And really, I hope you appreciate the incredible collection of incredible figures who were there in Tzfat at that time and who made Tzfat what it was. Behind me here, you see visions of the Galil. And as Ashira mentioned, from Tzfat, you could see the birthplace, the burial place of Reb Shimon Bar Yochai, Meron, which was a great inspiration to them. They wanted to be near Meron, near the great Reb Shimon Bar Yochai, who's associated with, and to them, maybe they felt you wrote the Zohar, the great mystical writings. And just like Reb Shimon Bar Yochai taught his son for 7 years, 14 years in a cave, so too the Marit, the Mabit, would merit it to have a son, the Maharit, who's also a great rabbi of his day. And really, from Tzfat, went to Constantinople and inspired a whole new generation of Sephardic giants at his time. But it's also interesting to note that they were not only Kabbalists in Tzfat, they were also great rabbis who were great halachists as well. It was a play of great fervor of both, and that the two coexisted. It wasn't viewed as, you know, somehow one is bad or good. There were people who did both, and there were people who sort of wrote in a sort of moderate way, like the Alshech and the Shlach, who were able to express very mystical ideas. They expressed it in a sort of toned-down way. I talked to Rabbi Brill. He didn't think it was a separate school, but one might suggest, I humbly suggest, that there were those who were trying to be more traditional and more toned down. Even Rabbi Elazar HaZikri, who Rabbi Brill says he eulogized the Ari at his funeral. But if you look at Rabbi Elazar HaZikri, he has two huge commentaries. He barely mentions anything about Kabbalah. the Rav Shlomo Alkovitz is capable of writing mystical books and other books in which there's nothing about Kabbalah. So I don't know if they sort of separated sometimes between one and the other. So that is my, I would like to formally end now, because I know some people might want to go to other classes, but if anybody has any questions or comments, they can do so. But again, thank you for joining us.